Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces of the United States, the President of the United States.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
It's almost 10 years now since U.S. military involvement in Vietnam came to a close. Some of your countrymen were unable to distinguish between our native distaste for war and the stainless patriotism of those who suffered its scars. And now we can say to you, and say as a nation, thank you for your courage. Thank you for being patient with your countrymen.
The Vietnam War was a conflagration, a raging firestorm on the battlefield and in the political arenas that savaged the United States domestically and ravaged Vietnam with a decade of devastation. From 1965 to 1972, the conduct of the war effort was complicated by Byzantine political maneuverings here at home, in Saigon, in Hanoi, in Moscow, and in other world capitals. Vietnam, however, was more than just a conflict between domestic hawks and doves, North Vietnamese communists and South Vietnamese patriots. It was a war where disinformation became the enemy's principal weapon, where the American press reached a zenith of power, prodding and getting an expanded American commitment in Vietnam, and then gullibly seeking and succeeding in undermining the resolve of America, its youth and its politicians, to defend a valiant ally from the scourge of communist aggression. It was the most misunderstood war in America's proud history. It was a war that was won, ironically, on the battlefield. It was lost, however, in the halls of Congress, where self-serving politicians denied vitally needed aid to the Vietnamese and the Cambodians. The suffering of 30 million people, the genocide, is a result of this betrayal. Indochina was turned into an Asian Auschwitz, and people are still getting into leaky boats and trying to escape the slave camps and hell holes that now exist in a once beautiful land. It was a war whose smoke and fire still smolders and swirls. Today, the factual record of Vietnam, from America's proper involvement to the proud participation of America's fighting men, is finally unfolding, reversing the tendrils of disinformation and misinformation that still flutter in the breezes fanned by pseudo-historians. On July 27th and 28th, 1984, Accuracy in Media and its chairman, Reed Irvine, convened in Washington, D.C., a panel of Vietnam War experts. Their initial goal was to critique and refute a blatantly distorted 13-part PBS series entitled Vietnam, A Television History. This flawed extravaganza, which cost $5.6 million, aroused passionate criticism from Vietnam veterans, Vietnamese refugees, scholars, politicians, and some journalists. But this panel of experts from all corners of the country did more than destroy the myriad myths perpetrated by the one-sided PBS documentary. Instead, they created a living testament to truth for future historians. In his opening remarks, Reed Irvine started to set the record straight when he declared,
"Vietnam was not lost because the communists had better soldiers, better weapons, or better military tactics and strategy. Vietnam was lost on the battlefield of words and ideas, and the PBS television history of Vietnam fails to teach that important lesson. And what is worse, it repeats and even amplifies the verbal and visual ammunition that had proven so successful during the war in sapping the will of the American people and their government to accomplish what they had spent 57,000 American lives and billions of dollars of treasure to achieve. In so doing, it teaches us not how to avoid our past errors, but encourages us to repeat them. On balance, it comes out on the side of those who, when they cry, 'No more Vietnams,' do not mean no more surrender of free world territory, but rather no more use of American military might to resist the spread of the cancer of communism. The meaning of 'no more Vietnams' is an invitation to the Soviets to carry out their plans for subversion and aggression without hinder."
Colin Gray, the former assistant director of the prestigious International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, concluded that many Americans are convinced that our country lost the war in Vietnam. As has already been pointed out, however, the facts paint a different picture. By mid or late 1972, the U.S. and the Republic of Vietnam had effectively won the war. The enemy was en route, its supply lines in tatters. But goaded by a hostile press, panicked by peace-at-any-cost marchers in the streets, a liberal Congress proceeded to discard that hard-earned victory. As John Colvin, the British Consul General in Hanoi during the war, once remarked, and I quote, "Victory in American hands was not so much thrown away as it was shunned." Or as U.S. Senator Sims recalls,
"As a member of Congress during the last two or three years of the Vietnam War, it's very difficult and unpleasant memory for me to think about what the blunt truth was and to tell what the blunt truth was. America lost the war in Vietnam on the floor of the Senate and the House of Representatives. The Congress of the United States legislated defeat in Vietnam."
Senator Sims accurately recalls that the biggest attack of the war was launched in April 1972. The Communists hurled 14 divisions, spearheaded by 600 Russian tanks, across the 17th parallel. The so-called Easter Offensive was South Vietnam's moment of truth. The final battle to decide the survival of our people, according to President Thieu. Unlike Tet 4 years earlier, U.S. military support was now very limited. Only 60,000 Americans were still in Vietnam. In the face of the massive communist offensive, President Nixon unleashed American air power. Tremendous tactical and strategic airstrikes were coupled with the belated mining of Haiphong Harbor to support a valiant Arvin ground force. Years later, the president publicly regretted that he hadn't mined the harbors in 1969. 95% of North Vietnam's ammunition, weapons, gasoline, and diesel fuels entered through Haiphong. Admiral Thomas Moorer, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and commander of the Pacific Fleet during Vietnam, vividly recalls the mining.
"We tried for 8 years to get authority to mine Haiphong Harbor. On May the 8th, 1972, President Nixon had told me, first he said, how long it'd take you to make a plan to do it, and I said about 3 seconds because I made it 8 years ago. Then he said, can you keep it a secret, because I want to go on TV just as the mines are striking the water. And I told him we could do that. And at that time, we were flying 1,000 sorties a day in Southeast Asia. We took only 26 aircraft out of 1,000, and they were gone for an hour and a half. And we dropped the mines in the Haiphong Harbor, and not one ship entered or left for nearly 2 years when we took the mines up ourselves. Now just think what would have happened, what the outcome would have been if we had done that in 1965.
Nevertheless, the domestic response to these overdue actions was predictable, as Senator Sims explains.
"The president's firm action was denounced by a storm of criticism in the liberal media and by the hand-wringers in the Congress. Senate Democrats voted to condemn Nixon's decision to mine Haiphong. Senator Hartke cried hysterically, 'We must act at once to reverse this fateful error. Armageddon may be only hours away.' But the American people overwhelmingly backed the president. A Singlinger poll showed that 76% of the American people supported President Nixon's initiatives in Vietnam. A Harris survey found that 55% supported the bombing of North Vietnam, 64% supported the mining of Haiphong, and 74% thought it important that South Vietnam not fall into the hands of the communists. The U.S. bombing and mining were vital, but if the communist drive was to be stopped, the Arvin forces had to stop it on the ground." As General Westmoreland explained, and I quote, "Here, apparently, was the ultimate test of the long years of the American effort to create a viable South Vietnamese armed force. Even as the test developed, the last American battalions began to move, not to help in the fight, but to complete the American withdrawal. As the results eventually demonstrated, the Arvin, for all of its many errors in plans and executions, no longer required the assistance of the American ground troops."
By September, the all-out communist offensive was crushed. 400 of the 600 tanks were destroyed. Close to 100,000 enemy troops had been killed. The survivors en route. Buttressed by U.S. air power and the mining of Haiphong, South Vietnam soldiers had effectively demonstrated their ability and determination to fight and defeat North Vietnam's best units. More importantly, America's combat troops were no longer needed for the defense of South Vietnam. It was under these promising conditions that Congress proceeded to legislate defeat. The veto-proof Case Church Amendment was pushed through on June 29, 1973, preventing further U.S. military involvement in Southeast Asia, as Senator Sims sadly recounts.
The terms of the Case Church were categorical, and I quote the language of the legislation: notwithstanding any provision of law on or after August 15, 1973, no funds herein or heretofore appropriated may be obligated or expended to finance directly or indirectly combat activities by the United States military forces in or over or from off the shores of North Vietnam, South Vietnam, Laos, or Cambodia. And I'm quoting President Ford now, and he said, unfortunately, the United States did not carry out its commitment to supplying the military hardware and economic aid to South Vietnam. If we had carried out those commitments we had made, the tragic sacrifices that were made by so many would not have been in vain. So what happened after enduring 360,000 casualties and spending more than $140 billion, the United States Congress left the field of the communists. Senator Fong of Hawaii told his Senate colleagues the hard truth. There is no question but what we have betrayed the Cambodians and we have betrayed the South Vietnamese. In my mind, there is no question that we have reneged on our commitments and we have not lived up to our commitments.
It is interesting to note that Senator Sims pointed out further falsehoods in the PBS communist whitewash. For one thing, the ARVN proved conclusively that they could fight effectively with adequate arms and air support. PBS, however, pictured the ARVN as disorganized, frightened, and unwilling to fight, despite the eventual rout of the communist offensive. Conveniently overlooked was the obvious fact that U.S. ground troops were no longer needed for the defense of South Vietnam. Secondly, Sims deflates the anti-American theme of the series. Here's Senator Sims again.
Describing the 1972 bombing, the narrator explains, and I quote, along with conventional bombing, bombing planes dropped napalm. As the narrator speaks, a picture is shown on the screen of a heart-rending scene of a little Vietnamese girl named Kim running down the street naked after presumably being hit by napalm dropped from an American plane. That's the presumption that you're left with when you watch the program. What the narrator did not explain was that the bomb which struck Kim and several South Vietnamese soldiers was accidentally dropped from a South Vietnamese sky raider. The scene illustrated not American bestiality, but a horrible South Vietnamese accident. Nevertheless, it was upon such evidence that the radical anti-American case in the PBS series rested with no response.
Soviet expatriate Alexander Solzhenitsyn once castigated American doves for handing Southeast Asia over to the communists. In a scathing commencement address at Harvard in 1978, Solzhenitsyn declared, and I quote, members of the U.S. anti-war movement wound up being involved in a betrayal of Far Eastern nations, in a genocide, and in the suffering of 30 million people there. Do these convinced pacifists hear the moans coming from there? Do they understand their responsibilities today? Or do they prefer not to hear? Georgetown University professor Nguyen Ngoc Bích, a Vietnamese expatriate, begs for an accurate reading of life under the communists.
Everything in Vietnam is so bitter. In 4,000 years of history, the Vietnamese have never left their land. In 30 years of the most devastating war that you had, no Vietnamese tried to run away from Vietnam. Why is it that in 6 years of peace or 8 years of peace or something, we have over a million people trying, desperately trying against, you know, all the risk of the sea piracy in Thailand, of an incredible amount of obstruction and obstacle outside. How do people do things like that? I think this is something that needs to be looking into.
The legacy of American shunned victory is, however, not just limited to the suffering millions in Indochina. The so-called Vietnam Syndrome, with its No More Vietnams bumper stickers, influences U.S. foreign policy in Central America and elsewhere today. The parallel is there. The thesis of the PBS series was that America's involvement in Vietnam was immoral and illegal from the beginning. Today, the disinformed would have you believe that the United States is supporting an unpopular, brutal government in El Salvador, and that we are interfering with a popular government in Nicaragua. Again, the party line. The price of greatness, Winston Churchill once said, is responsibility. For many reasons, we have moral obligations to support our friends and oppose the foes of freedom. In that context, we must follow President Reagan's common sense appraisal. Never ask our young men to fight and die for their country unless we intend to win. Tragically, North Vietnam's leaders were proven right when they predicted in 1968 that they would defeat the United States on the political front. A key element in their strategy was the American press. Veteran journalist Charles Wiley, who covered the Vietnam War, notes how deeply the media affected American policymakers, even those in the White House Situation Room.
Men who were around the president, who had every day openings to look at the cables that were coming in from our field commanders, from the CIA, who decided that what they saw on television was more important than what they were seeing at the center of government.
After Walter Cronkite narrated, in the face of all official pronouncements, a critical documentary, even Lyndon Johnson declared, "If I have lost Cronkite, I've lost the American people." Thus was the power of the press. Vietnam was a tragic war, and the media destroyed our resolve to tough it out. Captain Red McDaniel, a survivor of brutal treatment inflicted by his North Vietnamese captors, told the AIM conference,
"I believe a greater threat to this nation, even greater than the Soviet Union, is national media bias."
Freedom of the press has always been one of this nation's most cherished freedoms. America's media, with its constitutionally guaranteed privileges, illuminates a fundamental difference between open and closed societies. Yet the revisionist historians of PBS would have us believe otherwise. They totally overlooked the obvious. When observers, and I use that word loosely, were allowed to go to Hanoi, the only people they were allowed to interview were the people echoing the communist line. They became propaganda pawns of a state-controlled media which exists solely for the promotion of state power. If, however, the Vietnam War produced an imbalance in reporting by our own press, we cannot allow ourselves to similarly overreact, to vilify all media because of the faults of a few. Today, for example, a number of Vietnam veterans are in very influential positions in both print and broadcast journalism. Colonel Summers, who is on the staff of the Strategic Studies Institute of the Army War College, Carlisle Barracks, Pennsylvania, says,
"I find out that it's wrong, you know, it's worse than a crime, it's a folly, to totally condemn the media out of hand. In retrospect, that it's hard to see is that this country, the political leadership, and unfortunately, in my thesis, the senior military leadership, wasn't aware we were in a war until we'd lost it. We thought we were in a pacification program. We thought we were in a counterinsurgency program. And what was happening on the battlefield was not being translated back at the national level. You read a book, How Much is Enough, by Inhofe and Smith, which is sort of the Bible of the Pentagon in 1966, a 200-page book, 20 pages of which are devoted to Vietnam. And that was probably about right. About 10% of the attention at the highest levels was being paid to the war in Vietnam. It's hard to realize now that this was a back burner affair for a long time, until suddenly it boiled over the entire stove. It's illustrative to look at Great Britain, it seems to me, in the Falklands campaign versus the United States in Vietnam. As soon as the war started in the Falklands, the first thing Margaret Thatcher did was form a war cabinet. She knew that Great Britain was at war, and the entire prestige of the nation was on the line, even though the war itself was a very minor affair in the Falklands. And you look at the chain of command and the chain of authority that was given and the operational instructions that were given to the commander of the British fleet and compare that with a convoluted bureaucratic nightmare that we had to endure during the Vietnam War. And you see that we have major problems. One, there wasn't an awareness that when the United States goes to war, the entire prestige of the United States is on the line. We found that out, even though it may be a very small affair halfway around the world. And that's a hard point to get across. What we had, and I think one of the better definitions of our problems in Vietnam, was business as usual. That we never made the transition from peace to war that was necessary to get our act together. The feeling that, well, we knew better, and we had recommended better ways to do it, but it really didn't matter, because no matter what we did, we'd prevail. And what we ignored was the first fundamental of war. As Clausewitz told us 150 years ago, war is an exercise of will to compel the other side to do your bidding. It all rests on will. So one of the tragic failures of the Vietnam War was the deliberate decision by the administration not to mobilize the American will in support of the war. That was a deliberate act because the feeling was it would jeopardize the Great Society programs, and besides, this was such a small affair anyway, it wasn't really necessary. And then allied with that, the idea that you could exclude the American people from the strategic equation. Well, the American people ultimately had something to say about that.
Unfortunately, the PBS editors couldn't or wouldn't separate fact from fiction. Instead, they used visual images to distort the truth and support their premise. An in-depth presentation on the technical art of visual persuasion was presented by Peter Rollins, a professor at Oklahoma State, who was a Marine Company commander in Vietnam.
I am very much concerned as an academic with the media atmosphere in which our citizens live. And I feel very strongly that literacy today means the ability to read and write, but also the ability to read and decode visual messages, both film and television. And what disturbs me and what has been very much my goal as a writer and as a filmmaker is to promote visual literacy. And what needs to be done really in the classrooms of this country, high school, college classrooms, to make our citizens aware, to make them competent in an age of media atmosphere. So, of course, film is an art form, and the frightening thing, depending on what side of the screen you're on, the enjoyable thing, if you're on the producer's side, is that you can make an audience see, think, and feel any way you want them to see, think, and feel. It's just, it's show business, and it's powerful, and it's a delight to trick the audience. And this is frightening, but it's also true that a lot of, I think, deleterious messages for our society are communicated unconsciously based on the prejudices and gut feelings and choices and selections of stories to run and how to run them made by gatekeepers in our media. And well, I guess what frightens me is visual media, because people aren't trained to look and dissect and analyze visual media the way supposedly they're trained to read the newspaper, magazines, and so on.
He noted how the PBS series never touched upon the obvious, how television and television's visual reporting affected public opinion and foreign policy decisions. Every evening, the war was brought from the battlefield directly into the living rooms of most Americans, courtesy of their favorite network. Yet, on every possible occasion, PBS used inflammatory footage to exploit the repulsion, corruption, and horror of war to vilify America's conduct in this noble conflict. Here's what veteran correspondent Philip Clark has to say about PBS and the media's war coverage.
When this correspondent first went to South Vietnam in January 1970, it was because I could not believe what I was reading in the New York Times. In 1972, I still could not believe what I was reading and seeing on the tube. According to the New York Times and the networks, South Vietnam was about to collapse and surrender under the furious North Vietnamese Easter Offensive. The Arvin 5th Division, the so-so outfit with which I had spent most of my assignment in 1970, was reported surrounded and surrendering in a key provincial town called An Lac. If it fell, Saigon also would go. The PBS narrator doesn't mention An Lac, but his voice is full of doom when he describes how, quote, the swift enemy advance left little time for retreat, and, quote, with no American combat troops to support them, the South Vietnamese army seemed to be fighting a losing battle. South Vietnamese troops and their families battled for aircraft space to flee the enemy, unquote. Yet, from all I could gather, Anh Lạc continued to hold out. So I went back to South Vietnam to get the story of the incredible siege of Anh Lạc. I first offered to do the story for the New York Times. I got a letter from some editorial assistant rejecting my proposal and suggesting sarcastically that, quote, no one would even remember Anh Lạc in a few weeks, unquote. Or as he inferred, give a damn. I did get the Reader's Digest to publish my story a year later, and ironically, it was entitled The Battle That Saved Saigon.
There are a great many people who have a vested interest in locking history in place as it might have been in the late 1960s and early 1970s. What's another communist incursion into some small, remote democracy to them? There is an irony in all this. Recent studies are dissecting the anti-war protesters. The studies are finding that the ones who are really suffering today are the ones who didn't serve their country in Vietnam. They're the ones that are guilt-ridden, not the proud veterans. They are the ones that are trying to explain to their children why they ran away to avoid serving their country. The PBS series was little more than an attempt to freeze history, to justify past indiscretions, as Colonel Summers aptly says.
If you look at the documentary in that light, as an attempt to freeze history, if you will, and to justify why they were morally right in what they did, then you have some of an explanation of why this series went the way it did. But my point is that won't wash. History is not on their side. The truth will out.
Our story continues on side two. Please turn your cassette over.